been talking, it's really been fascinating to see what you think of my own home and what is the object that in my life that resonate with memories and things I really don't usually think about. And I wondered, because presumably when you're involved in the project, what for you, either in the museum or in your life, is the object that is the most that sums something up to you in the way that these things have done?
Well, inevitably it's things that I remember seeing, you know, when I was very young. And obviously I've worked there all my life, I've seen things many times over, but there is wonderful votive figures from Sumer. You see rows and rows of them in the Mesopotamian galleries. But it's partly, you know, because they're there in an attitude of devotion. I used to think how patient they looked. They sat there, you know, they stood there, I should say, with their hands folded, you know, and this air of calm sort of acceptance. and it was they that sort of the fascination of a really ancient civilization. There's some, you know, was encapsulated by them.
Had you seen them when you were a child?
Yes.
Taken by them?
Yes. I mean, I went often as a child. I mean, also because that's when the British Library collections were still in the museum. So other images, things that made a great impression on me were certain manuscripts, both illuminated manuscripts. And, you know, it's an obvious one, but never forget seeing, you know, Scott's diary, which is always open at the final page, you know, a diary, you know, and an autograph is an object too.
I think the issue about whether a painting is an object is a very interesting one, because I was thinking about this and thinking, well, it feels not quite right looking at objects in a painting. So it is something slightly different. But if I think of it the other way around, about paintings I have, I definitely would view them as objects with stories around them. But there's a difference somehow. I don't know why. They are objects.
Yes, yes.
Definitely.
Well,
I feel differently looking at a painting as an object.
Yes.
But it represents objects.
So
it's at a different level.
Yeah.
Yes. Or it does
somehow.
Both.
Yes. Yeah, of course.
But also because I think people have much less physical experience of paintings, you know, unless they make them themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, very few people own paintings. On the whole. They're used to seeing them on the walls of galleries, so there's a distance.
But even if it's a print or something,
yes, but everything has a physical presence. I mean, it's why, you know, earlier on, talking about how lovely it is to be able to go into the students' room of the prints and drawings department, which all of you are most welcome to come to. You need no appointment or anything, just turn up with regular ID and the stated opening hours, and you can see anything you like in the collection. And then you can hold it mounted and what have you. But, you know, there you are, right up close and personal with Michelangelo, Leonardo, and, you know, an infinite number of other. But you realise that these things have a physical presence. So often I find that exhibitions, displays have been chosen by people who inevitably have gone through slides now, they've looked at them on the screen, where everything is flattened, everything is made to look the same size. I mean, I've certainly been to exhibitions where you realise that the people organising kind of had no idea of what the original looked like, because it is either, you know, much, much smaller than is obviously appropriate, or it's much, much bigger, or it's got a frame too, you know, it's the presentation of it that matters hugely. But, you know, this was a very carefully constructed still life. She was very influenced by Van Gogh's still life, but this was constructed as ready as a memento then of the house they'd had to leave because their circumstances had declined. They were still quite comfortably off, but it was tremendous, and there must have been a sense of loss about that childhood home. And I should say that the Motyshitskys were neighbours of Edmund de Waal's family. You know, there were so many interconnections here, and in Vienna, or at least a branch of his family, the Afusis in Vienna. And then in the post-war era, it took on even more significance, which is, you know, why her mother, as it were, rescued it from the exhibition and actually bought it back and wrote this poem. And of course, the loss of Karl, who was, you know, a remarkable, very brave man, was deeply felt. And Marie-Louise always blamed herself for not having saved him, although it was his own decision to stay. He could have left. And the estate Hinterbrühl, where this was painted, and where they lived latterly, in 1956 she went back with her mother, and she sold it to the man who started the Children's Village movement. It was in 1949 it was started for, you know, orphan displaced children. It's a huge global charity now. They have them in 124 countries, and indeed there were close links between Anna Freud and the Children's Village movement. They don't just act as sort of orphanages now, they're much more multifaceted. Services they provide in supporting children and families, and have a very Hinterbrühl, which is the largest of the children's villages. The former Mojtyszycki estate is now one of the great centres in Europe for child psychotherapy.
I've realised just now the title, and it has brought my attention, is A History.
A History, yes.
Not The History.
No, that was quite deliberate, because it was, we couldn't possibly tell a definitive history.
Yes.
It was just a version of history.
That's why it brought my attention, because I thought I very
yes.
much like that. It's
yes.
challenging, or it's in contrast of
yes.
the idea that the history is an objective past mm-hmm. That historians, for example, find and they write, and this is how the past was.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like, I suppose it's like psychoanalysis, you revisit the past, but there is not an objective past.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you revisit the past, a new story can,
yes.
can come up, and I suppose this is what the project is bringing together, isn't
yes.
it? Thinking about the past, but in so many different, with so many different narratives.
And it was certainly my colleagues who were principally involved in the 100 Objects series worked very, very hard to try and prevent any Eurocentricity. So it was largely conceived and delivered by Europeans, but the objects, the cultures and so on discussed, Europe actually doesn't feature very largely. And we were all terribly conscious of the fact that, obviously, the history we learnt in school left out huge amounts, huge passages of time, parts of the world, and you know, things take on a completely different significance according to where you were born, where you were brought up, and so on, where you're from. Our ignorance is vast. So a history, certainly not the
yeah.
history.
Do you think that is the reason why it took the public imagination so much? I mean, it suddenly there's this explosion of interest in, you know, something.
Yes, I think it was. I mean, it was, you know, it was incredibly well narrated, and obviously, you know, composed, written before that. The 15-minute format, which is what Radio 4 uses a lot, actually, and there were precedents, you know, this project came out of precedents, so none anything like as ambitious as the 100 Objects and the rest of the history of the world, is a very good one. You know, you can hold people's attention for that time. And I was, again, discussing just before the main event this evening, was that this broke completely new ground for Radio 4 and, you know, really moved them into the sort of digital age properly, because there were many more podcast downloads of the programmes than there were people listening to the broadcast. There were very good listening figures and hugely high approval ratings, but there have been 12 million, possibly more now, podcast downloads worldwide, and not many, many outside the UK, because that's something they can track. So, and it's something that people will come to through different routes. But I think, you know, just something which is crisp and clear, has the website presence too, and is encapsulating human history, is very appealing to people. You know, people were all looking for ways in to big subject, you know, that has performed the function admirably.
Do you think a house can be an object?
Yes,
was there architecture at all, or was that beyond the scale?
There were small structures, yes. Mm. I mean, we did have restrictions at first about not having buildings. Not making it too diffuse. But I teach on a course at King's College London representing the 18th century, and we have a seminar called Writing About Objects, and one of my colleagues on the course is historian Ludmilla Jordanova. She's writing a book on Wren's Library at Trinity College, Cambridge, and she said, we started off by saying how important it was to describe objects, you know, whether it's the Rosetta Stone or whether it's the Wren Library in Cambridge, which she then did beautifully, and she said that helps you to relate to it.
Because I think that's quite interesting, your relationship with an object, if it's a very small intimate object like one of Edmund's Savory's nets, okay, or if it's a building that you actually enter into and you become this very small person, but you still have these incredible associations. I mean, I grew up in an old farmhouse in the Midlands, which I left when I was about 18, and yet looking back, it was like a third parent, that house to me, and that, you know, when you were talking about all these things that are often start in our childhood, these connections and associations. That was the one that first came into my mind, you know, this old farmhouse that was like this incredibly secure.
And we invest buildings and personalities too, don't we?
Very much so.
Yes, most definitely. Mm. What objects would, I mean, this is an exercise that we perform with sort of BBC producers around the country, but we ask people to nominate, you know, objects that were of particular significance to themselves. You asked me something. Yes. You know,
well,
something
already, I was just trying to think, actually, things in my house that I own, and one of them would be, there are two of them, actually, and they're both items of clothing. One is a dress designed by my grandmother, who was a dress designer, who was born in 1904. And became a dress designer when she was 16, working with her family, and carried on doing it. And I was very, very close to her. And after she died, I started buying her dresses, which I can still, because she was a fashion dress designer, she had a label. I mean, she wasn't, you know, a couture designer. The first one that I bought, which is a green satin long dress with beading on the bottom, and it sort of started me off collecting her clothes, which I've now got my entire wardrobe is full of long evening dresses, which I can't wear for anything, most of which don't fit me. But I suppose that dress, probably, it's very beautifully made, and she had thick styles. She always used to do these low backs to her evening dress. So it would probably be that.
I mean, we were actually thinking of having part of the exhibition that we've got here, having the pictures of staff members at the museum and objects that they chose. Mm. And then visitors would have to match the object with the person, and then they'd lift up. So it'd be a sort of game, you know, and you get the story. So we all sort of were thinking of objects. And the object I had, which was actually, I've just realised, you know, because it seems like a very personal object, that's a kind of unique thing, and in fact it's completely generic, which is, it's a cricket ball. That would be my object. You know, obviously, it's one of several which I have around the house, you know. And then, you know, there'd be stories about what experiences would be related to it and so on, and dreams and various other things, you know, to do with it. And that was my object. So it's sort of impersonal, but very personal to me, you know, in a way.
Because we had, more the BBC producers had to do a lot of interviewing with people, curators, ordinary members of the public, about particular objects and to, as it were, extract a story from them. And it's quite difficult at first, you know. Obviously, as a seasoned presenter and journalist can do that very well. It was quite difficult even for experienced curators to really be able to come up with the most important aspects of the story, and often they'd focus on really quite minor details or get to the heart of the matter, and that's where, of course, the skill of writing is so important, and how you'd say a great deal with very few words, and how you've got to capture the attention straight away.
But is that sort of relationship between the personal meanings that people have, or, you know,
yes.
And then somehow, in some way that's really difficult to put a finger on, it interacted with the programmes which were about global history, you know, how did that happen? I mean, it's kind of, you know, that people listening to that programme somehow became aware of this explosion, and suddenly there's a lot more objects in the world than there used to be, you know, and they had significance to them, you know, and it's kind of, and why didn't it happen before, you know, how comes it just suddenly? That's a kind of quite an odd thing. Really.
We had lots of museum curators at the beginning because they were under great time pressure to get their objects on the website with the entries, and they were the main body of the text. They were restricted to 150 words maximum, and one after another, you know, complained that they couldn't possibly do justice to their objects in 150 words. And so my principal BBC colleague, who's from the Northern Ireland office, as it were, he said, "Now come on," he said, "you know, the Apostles' Creed has only got 122 words, or various according to which version, and that covers birth, death, and resurrection. So surely you can talk about your objects 150 adequately." But again, we come back to Hemingway and his six-word short story.
I think one of the other objects we put was Freud's glasses, which we put out from the website. And there you only need to have the headline in one of the papers when you arrive. You know, "He can see through you."
Well, glasses and yes, things like that. And shoes, of course. Shoes are sort of extraordinarily eloquent objects. Yeah. And obviously, Holocaust Memorial Day, we think of the piles of shoes, camps and so on. But Van Gogh's boots. I went to a small museum in Godalming in Surrey, which is a great centre of the arts and crafts movement in the late 19th century, and it's where Gertrude Jekyll lived and designed quite a number of gardens. And Gertrude Jekyll's garden boots are in the local museum. And I said, you've got to contribute those to history of the world, because they were so eloquent in people's footwear.
Mm, this is like the imprint of that part in their shoes.
Yes, yes.
The shape of their foot.
Yes.
Steps they've
taken. No, these are very well worn. You know. They weren't, wasn't, you know, like an Elder Marcus's footwear, you know, lining the insides of closet.
Well, I think there just has been in the last 20 to 25 years a much greater connection between the world of museum culture and storing of objects in museum and how that touches everyday life and the everyday lives of people. And that's partly because museums have opened their doors to artists, and you know, visual culture has become something people talk about, material culture we talk about.
Yes.
And so that magic of the everyday, that an everyday object can somehow turn into something special, is just a more and more accessible idea to people. You know, it isn't just in a museum, you know, that you can take a little object which could have been the Coke bottle of its time, you know, sort of little water jar from Knossos or something, you know, and look at an everyday object today. And there's been a lot of stuff, you know, with James Putnam about, and Richard Wentworth, those kind of artists,
yes,
where they find everyday objects. And so I think that dialogue is much more open than it was, you know, 30 years ago. It was much more separate. And I think that's why the magic of objects is really a sort of in the time.
The 100 Object Series, the British Museum component, was not meant to be primarily about subjective responses.
No.
Starting with the objects and using the evidence. But then it did involve other kinds of testimony, because the other voices in the programmes were sometimes specialists, but sometimes, you know, they were just people expressing an opinion, which was and talking about the resonance of that object with a contemporary situation. So, I mean, there was no such thing as an entirely objective account anyway.
Yeah.
But the nice sort of contrast, in a way, with the wider project was that was much more relaxed, the wider project. It was much more democratic, obviously, once the public joined in. People at the museum and some of the initial group of participating museums are quite tense about that, you know, but actually people could understand, they could see the distinction, and all approaches, you know, had their value, and you know, the public appreciated the sort of rigour of the BM series and the other things, but also they appreciated being able to join in and make their contribution.
I wonder if it'll have an impact on how exhibitions are curated in the future, and whether there'll be spin-offs from this, in the sense that all museums will see how effective it's been.
It's very, I mean, because there were no exhibitions. I mean, and this was.
No, but I mean, whether,
yes,
you know, you could pick objects and display them in a particular way and tell the stories out.
They've been doing that already, and some museums are doing a project for the Culture of Olympiad called Stories of the World. But the spin-offs directly from the history of the world. And Cornwall decided at the very end of the year that they would like to do a history of Cornwall and the 100 objects from Cornish Museum. So they've done it. They've got everything up on the website. And they're doing programming this year after the main project is finished. Leicestershire did the same. And there were lots of initiatives like that. And then because, you know, BBC is endlessly copying itself, BBC Three's just had a Mozart, a couple of weeks, you know, Mozart Fest, and they did history of Mozart through 12 objects.
But I think what made the 100 objects so interesting, and why everyone got hooked on listening to it, was partly also because what each object was and what it made you see, each object was a window into a completely different world, you know, a different culture, and that's what to me made it so interesting, and the whole thing, so it was like having 100 little windows on the world that you hadn't looked through before.
Yes.
Rather than it being predictable things, and I think because, you know, it could have been probably much more predictable than it was. You know, you could have picked objects that were terribly well known, but some of them were very small things.
Yes. Well, the idea was to have a judicious balance. Obviously, you needed some really famous objects like the Rosetta Stone, but there were an awful lot which were much less well known. Things which hadn't been on display ever, in some cases, were brought out. The other nice thing, and lots of museums around the country commented on this, was that it focused on the permanent collections, because so many museums have got into the habit of putting all their effort into temporary exhibitions and thinking that's the only way, particularly if you're very dependent on repeat visits, which most museums outside central London are, because there isn't a big tourist audience. But it made them really, you know, appreciate what they have already, you know, and how much more they can make of it in a whole variety of ways. And the BBC people said, you know, we really enjoyed getting to know our local collections. We had no idea. There were such treasure troves of stories, you know, not necessarily valuable items commercially, as it were, monetarily.
Could I just ask one more? Sorry.
Yeah.
Were the 100 objects chosen by committee?
It was a lengthy process, and there were many people involved, and trying to arrive, as I said, at a good distribution across time and cultures, countries. And then, of course, it was discussed with Neil McGregor, the director, with the BBC. And of course the need, which was a need anyway, to have coherent themes for each week, because although people would not necessarily listen to 5 programmes on the trot, you needed to have that theme informing the approach to that group of programmes, and it was particularly important on the web, because you need themes, as, you know, for the search mechanism, and I think that was something that my colleagues who led on the 100 objects hadn't really understood at the beginning, you know, how important the web was going to be in the architecture of knowledge.
So was there a short list of like 1,000 objects and
no,
a long list of 10,000?
No, it was narrowed down much more than that, and then it was seeing how they would work within themes and discussion with the BBC, you know, from a programming point of view, whether it would make good radio, and obviously the director had particularly at the very end, did have, you know, a final sort of editorial say. And as always, when things have been chosen, it seems easy in retrospect, but it certainly wasn't. And it was very, when the museums who came in for the launch of the project, museums, BBC partners around the country, and we asked each region to choose 10 objects that represented, you know, their history of the world. And of course, you know, that they found, you know, it was incredibly difficult, but they really enjoyed doing it, because it made them think about the narrative, it made them think about the connections between their places and the rest of the world.
I mean, there's something just about the idea that, you know, if you say anyone can do it, you know, suddenly, you know, I mean, we've got our 25th anniversary coming up this year, with bound to do the history of the Freud Museum in 25 objects. And, you know, or the history of the mind in 100 objects, or, you know, you can go anywhere.
That
would
be a great series, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you can. So, if anyone's got any ideas, just email me.
Yes, well, you need to talk to BBC about that.